that football folk is doing. Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, fam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson. Sam, fix up.
I don't think we really need these.
We don't. Fix the desk. Here we are. Happy Tuesday morning. We're a little bit late with the podcast, but we warned you about this because Memorial Day weekend, we said, hey, we're going to go on Tuesday. It's June, so of course we're going to be talking the best and worst supporting casts in the NFL. How you doing, man?
That was way less elegant than the Collinsworth slide.
Yeah, you might want
to. To be fair, I had greater distance travel. I mean, I had that was... That's a long way.
I liked Chris's explanation of the slide and how it all came about and all that stuff on our on the PFF NFL podcast a few weeks ago.
I do find it incredibly endearing that he thought that that meme was like real. Okay, not for long, but you know.
Yeah.
A couple of seconds. Was like, do they think, oh no, it's fake.
They were all waiting, watching me at a bar. It's great. So it's Tuesday morning. We're going to have our regular Thursday podcast, but today we're going supporting cast because it's, you know, it's essentially like rankings season. Here at PFF, we have all of our player rankings. We had our player ranking show last week where we went through it.
Do you want to explain why there's a giant baseball mitt sitting next to me?
So that's my Spalding outfielder's glove.
Outfielder's glove.
Yes, and this is just a snippet, just a piece of the uniform that you'll be wearing once we raise the $1,500 for charity to get you to have like your Afro equivalent show. You're going to dress up as Minor League Steve.
Minor League Steve, using your game worn, presumably, minor league. Well, I don't know. Did you?
I did not use that. That's not my gamer.
It was not a gamer.
No.
Okay. Mostly game worn.
That was a placeholder.
Minor League Steve outfit. Now, the added benefit of all that is that it's going to be, I mean, you and I are not exactly the same size.
Yes.
So whatever you're supplying me with is going to be at least 2X's larger than anything I'm supposed to be wearing.
I think we should take a vote from the fans, too. I can make you into a San Francisco Giant or a Seattle Mariner based off what I have. So it'll probably be a big game jacket with the pants and my cleats.
The cleats will be the best one because the glove is where we probably have the largest disparity in terms of like body part size, but you inform me that apparently you have like a small glove for reasons I don't want to hear it, but the cleats would be the next biggest, right? Like I wear a size 10 shoe and your cleats are size 16.
Yeah,
so that's quite a large
and metal
difference. The metal
slipping
clunking
all over the place if you try to
move. Well, the Collinsworth slide wouldn't work with those.
No,
but anyway,
the floor might get ruined.
That's true. So if you want to donate to this charity and make this thing happen, it's my pinned tweet right now. It sends you to a GoFundMe. We're raising money for the Make-A-Wish Foundation, the tri-state area local one. I'm not sure what difference it makes other than, you know, they're local. So the Make-A-Wish Foundation, you know, make some wishes happen for kids. We'll raise a bunch of money. And if and when we break that barrier, I got to do a show sitting here dressed up as Minor League Steve. I will buy the ridiculous curly wig so we can rock that. I will think about shaving down to just the mustache.
The 2009 version, just stash.
Just stash, 2009.
Those are minor league rules for every team except like the A's and the Red Sox. I don't know if things have changed. I've been out of the game for a few years now. But most minor league organizations only allow you to have a neatly trimmed mustache. Or they will word it as no facial hair below the lip. So we did have a few humans.
What if you're?
They did the whole like straight across all the way to the earlobe. it was like below your ear, whatever it was. But
straight across line up.
Would have facial hair.
That's a good one. It's like the cops in Ireland, right? They're called An Garda Síochána. They have a rule where you can either be clean shaven or you can have a beard, but you can't grow a beard like on company time, right? So you have, if you want to grow a beard from like a non-bearded starting point. You essentially have to grow it during your vacation time.
You can't grow a beard on...
Correct. So you can't...
Who is this?
The cops in Ireland. Interesting. So you can be... You can be clean shaven or you can have a beard. You can't go from one to the other whilst being a cop. So if you want to go from one to the other, you essentially have to do it during your vacation time and come back with a beard.
Would this count as a beard? And then can I add... Then
I think you've got to be... I don't think you can pull
like if I grew this in vacation, it's like, all right, you're bearded now.
Well, no, I just don't think you can. They would look at you and they'd be like, you can't come in and work with that kind of crap. You got to go shave.
We were in spring training one time.
Oh, God.
And
have you seen it?
What?
The meme. No, it's not the meme guy. It's the.
Who's attacking us now?
J Mart and Ramon, the Tennessee podcast or the Tennessee radio thing that we're both on.
Yeah. Ramon Foster.
Yeah, yeah. They've sent a picture of me riding your shoulders as a child at some sort of theme park.
You didn't
park.
Know that?
I mean, I've seen it before,
that was
but only
months ago.
Thrown at you like this in the course of a random...
meme guy made that his avatar.
Yeah. It's not my favorite picture, I'll say that.
It's pretty funny. That's why we're growing, Sam. Because J. Martin Ramon, stuff like that. We had a guy, quick story, but in spring training, we're out there, stretch lines and all that stuff, and a couple of the coaches come down, they're like, hey, sponsors are here today. The Giants sponsors are here.
Okay.
Everybody's got to be clean shaven. So we have a former major leaguer. He's now stuck in the minors with the rest of us. He's in his 30s. He's got a little beard going, and they're like, get upstairs and shave. So he goes up there and he's like, all right, just grabs a razor and just starts shaving dry, just cutting himself up, comes back out onto the field like blood everywhere, and he's like, is this better for the sponsors? So there was a lot of you're telling grown men how to, how to shave and how
like
not
that.
To shave and all that stuff. Right. Sometimes there's a revolt. So you get a lot of ugly mustaches. You get a lot of ridiculous. Yeah. You get guys gushing blood.
Can you imagine if PFF had like a prescribed facial hair doctrine? It wouldn't go well. Like,
don't give any ideas.
I'm just saying people would rebel.
Yeah. To like the letter of the law, we would follow it out. All right. So let's get into best supporting cast. So I'm writing this article.
First go donate. Then.
Oh, yeah. So go to. So it's at PFF underscore Sam. Again, his pinned tweet. Go put in even just a few bucks. It all helps. It'll add up. We're thinking we'll get to this at some point this summer before the season starts. The earlier, the better. And I'll make sure I have all my best uniform to give you. All right.
We're really looking forward to it.
Yeah. I get some old school stirrups. So I think the Giants is going to be the best thing. Stirrups.
Those are the things that you...
The old school stirrups.
The only stirrups I know of are the things you put on a horse to get on it. What the hell are you talking about?
So watch any baseball game from before the 90s.
Right.
And you would see guys with, like they'd have like the white called sanitary sock. And then they have the colored sock over it.
Yeah.
And those are called stirrups. And you get like old school, like back in the 50s and 60s, they jack up the pants and you get these really nice stirrups. And the Giants, when Barry Zito was there, of course, he would always wear the stirrups. Just look up Barry Zito. I have those. I have the Barry Zito stirrups.
Why are they called stirrups and not socks?
Because of the way that I'll show them to you. They're stirrupy. They go like under your foot and they come up and I'll show it to you. But we got the stirrups to go with the Giants pants. It'll probably be a Giant show is what I'm thinking.
Okay.
All right. Fans have had enough.
Yeah.
I'm writing the article of the best wide receiver tight end wide receiver and tight end units in the league. What's so funny now?
Sometimes when you look at the PFF Slack, you wonder why you're there. Bruce got added to the group that talks about, working out and health and all that kind of stuff. And he's apparently going on an intermittent fasting, supposed to be fasting for 12 hours, and is already at breakfast and wanting to tap out.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So it's just a message.
That's why that group exists.
Bruce Gradkowski, former NFL player, 11 years in the league, is busy trying to tap out of an intermittent fasting that hasn't made it past 9:40 a.m.
He's going on 12 hours. That's it.
And eight of those, you would have been sleeping. Like he's been awake for an hour and is looking to tap out and needs food.
I love how this went too. He was added to this by Ben Stockwell.
Yeah, he's already been bugging Ben about
this. Bruce went to bed. He's like, man, I'm just really struggling with this fasting deal. Ben's like, I know what to do.
I've been awake for an hour and I can't deal with this anymore. Help me through it.
I'll add you to our chat.
Oh, God. What are we doing here?
Neil will be typing within a few minutes here to give all sorts of advice, and I can't wait for it. That's Neil's biggest purpose.
Look, whatever you do, don't eat beyond 6 p.m. because that's when the crisis starts.
Just kidding. Neil's CEO, running all sorts of stuff. But he's very helpful in our workout chat. All right, are we ready to talk some football now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably.
I'm writing wide receiver tight end units. Who's got the best? Okay. And we decided for this, we'll talk all supporting cast. So include running back. We won't include defense. We're not going to consider the defense supporting cast. We're talking offensive supporting cast. So we're talking best and worst. Who has the best supporting cast in the league? Here's my... for just wide receivers and tight ends, I got the Bucs ranked number one. Their running backs had the lowest receiving grade in the NFL last year. They could not catch a pass. Couldn't do anything after the pass. Yeah, after the catch with Leonard Fournette and Ronald Jones. Despite the running backs and what they do in the pass game, do the Bucs have the best supporting cast in the NFL?
I think there's they're definitely in the running. The Bucs have arguably the best receiving core, top to bottom, in the NFL. The best, if you go by your rankings. I don't know why you wouldn't, but you know.
Thank you.
Offensive line, they've got a top, what, 5-7 offensive line. That's a really good unit. They added some depth in the draft this year. The offensive line is in good shape. I think we should include coaching as well, you know, add any sort of boost for scheme that's in there. I think the Bucs scheme is fine. It's not, you know, it's not one that's massively boosting the talent around it, but it has Tom Brady to work with. So yeah, I think the Bucs top to bottom, I mean, look, we've been saying that top to bottom, this is one of the best rosters in the NFL, arguably the best. Once they got their stuff together at the end of last season, they went on this run. They were incredible. They brought everybody back. They have added pieces, specifically with depth, receiver, and offensive line, at which point, yeah, it's got to be one of the best supporting casts out there.
And just to remind people who exactly they have, Mike Evans and Chris Godwin as the top two receivers, Antonio Brown as the third. Now, in my head, I always put Antonio Brown as the third receiver out of that group. And he pretty much was last year.
Well, the thing is, they don't really... The way that receiving core worked last year, it didn't really have a sort of, you know, number three like that. It was just like specific games, depending on what the defense was showing them. Like, that would be an Antonio Brown game. Then that would be, they were like rotated who the third guy was almost, and actually who the second and sometimes the first guy was.
And here's the thing I would say, too. As I was writing them up and you're looking at what they did last year, they could be even scarier this year. Mike Evans had his lowest grade of his career because he had a hamstring injury. He battled injury. So there's always reason for production, you know, issues. He still caught 15 touchdowns, including the playoffs. And there were points where they put him in the slot and, you know, he wasn't really easy to cover at all. But when Mike Evans is healthy, you know, he's one of the better receivers in the league. He wasn't necessarily that from start to finish last year. Chris Godwin missed time due to injury. Antonio Brown missed a playoff game due to injury. So they all missed time. So that trio...
And Chris Godwin got to the playoffs and couldn't catch anything.
Then he dropped 7 passes. The most ridiculous stat, PFF, premium stats, you go check it out and go check out Chris Godwin's page and see that he has 13 career drops, 7 of which took place in a 3-game stretch in the playoffs.
Yeah.
From wild card through conference championship week.
Five of them came in one game, right?
5 in one game against the football team, I believe, in the wild card round. So just absolutely crazy. So you've got that trio. And then, you know, my favorite thing is you always have that designated deep threat. That's Scotty Miller. And we did some work using next-gen stats and what guys are actually running on the field. Scotty Miller, I think he was the fastest receiver in the NFL last year, even faster than Tyreek Hill based off some of the work that Eric and the R&D team have done. And you saw that on the field. Scotty Miller is a deep threat. Tyler Johnson's another good a good receiver. And then Jaden Mickens, who they just drafted. I'm sorry, reading the wrong guy.
Jalen
Darden, who they just drafted as a slot receiver with even more speed. And then they also have 3 tight ends who could start. You know, as we're going through all the tight ends in the NFL, Cameron Brate probably starts for 10 teams in the league.
Yeah.
And he's the third tight end on maybe 10 to 15 teams in the NFL. Cameron Brate's the top guy. And he's the third tight end on the Bucs. So they're absolutely loaded.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think
that's Rob Gronkowski, OJ Howard coming back.
There's a reason that they're right up there in terms of Super Bowl favorites. And Tom Brady has been the team that makes the difference, bridges the gap between a good team and a team that's the Super Bowl favorite or one of the top two. But the reason that that is the difference between that and the Patriots team that Tom Brady left is the supporting cast. Like, the Bucs have a way better supporting cast than the Patriots that he left do. And that's the reason that the Patriots, even with Tom Brady, we're not contending for a Super Bowl that year.
And as I mentioned, if there was a weakness, it is pass catching by the running backs. They do add Giovanni Bernard. And it's not like he's, you know, he's not James White or anything.
He can catch.
But he can at least catch the ball.
Different to any of the other guys they have.
In the way the Bucs use their, you'll catch, the running backs will generally catch a few screens and checkdowns.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of split them out wide and, you know, create mismatches. It's just those couple things. Just catch the ball when we need you to catch it.
Yeah.
And Bernard can do
that. I mean, the two of the, like, Ronald Jones has some of the worst hands I've ever seen from a running back. When you were looking at his college tape, it's like the guy had 45 targets or something across his entire college career. And within those 45 targets, there were three or four horrendous drops. You're like, that's not great. And Leonard Fournette looks like every single pass he catches is like double caught. The guy almost never catches it cleanly. Like Gio, whatever you think about him and how good he can be, the guy can catch the ball, particularly out of the backfield. Like, he might not have, you know, the ability to split out wide as a slot weapon or a true wide receiver and take reps that way, but the guy can catch dump offs out of the backfield and make a little bit of something happen.
So when so let's agree the Bucs are number one. They're going to be the number one team on my wide receiver tight end rankings that are coming out at pff.com. Where I always battle back and forth when I'm trying to think of these rankings, and as we, you know, go into some of our chats with some of the other, you know, PFF talent here and discuss, hey, who, you know, where would you put
these? You cannot use the term talent.
You can't use talent?
Not unironically on a podcast. People don't understand that's like the actual technical term.
I know.
That's true. For this role, you sound like an asshole.
I know. It's become so familiar with me.
Yeah.
That, it's not talent. It's just writers, podcasters. Yeah,
just people that do stuff.
People. The forward-facing people in the company that you guys know about. When we debate these things, I always struggle with...
This is not a term that we came up with, This is like, you go to ESPN... That's what they call the people in front of the camera.
Like Stephen A. Smith is the talent.
Right. Us sitting here right now would be termed talent.
Talent.
So we have some
has
would
nothing
say,
to do with our skills.
Right. We would some would say unfortunately have adopted that term for that role within PFF.
Yeah, can't use behind the scenes. Right. That was big.
But now
big.
You go and drop it on the podcast.
Black mark.
Yeah. As if people know that and just make us look, well, you look like an asshole.
Stupid. Really stupid. My bad. Anyway. As we're debating these rankings, I always go back and forth between the teams that either have one stud receiver or even two stars like the Chiefs. How good are Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce, even if 3, 4, and 5 aren't as good as teams like the Cowboys or the Bills? So how do we balance a top two versus teams that have really good depth and they roll 4 or 5 deep as far as playmakers? So I think the next couple teams that are in the mix, Dallas Cowboys, their trio of receivers, the Kansas City Chiefs with Hill and Kelce, the Bills, they're rolling 4 strong at receiver. The Vikings might have the very best wide receiver duo in the NFL when it comes to Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen. So how do you balance? How would you balance a top two versus, say, the depth of having 3 or 4 really good pass catchers?
It's tough. I'm always on the fence about which way you lean in this particular thing. I mean, the Packers have shown that, look, Davante Adams can get you a really long way. Just him, right? And it won't take you the whole way. And the narrative every offseason is, God, they need somebody else, anybody else. They need a secondary receiving threat so that it isn't just Rodgers to Adams. On the other hand, Rodgers to Adams has been pretty freaking good, right? It's taken them a fairly long way, and it's good. Like, there's a lot of teams that would kill for that. So I think particularly with receiver, one guy can take you a really long way. The Dallas versus Kansas City one is interesting because I think player for player, Dallas runs deeper and it probably has more, particularly when you're looking at the offensive line as well. But that's where I think you can look at the scheme and the coach and say, all right, if Dallas has a slight edge in talent, Kansas City jumps back and takes even more when you start adding in, hey, Andy Reid is controlling this offense and Eric Bieniemy. And okay, they might have less depth in terms of, you know, once you get to Mecole Hardman, who even the Chiefs don't seem to trust that much, it gets pretty sketchy pretty quickly. And if anything does happen to Tyreek Hill or Travis Kelce, that could start to fall off quickly. But, like, look at the track record of what Andy Reid has been able to do within these offenses. And I would say that, you know, particularly versus Dallas, where they're in danger of having the same issues that that coaching staff has had in previous spots, you would favor the Chiefs as a total package in terms of supporting cast around their quarterback.
with the Chiefs, so good points on all that. I would probably rank the Chiefs second because of what you said. From a wide receiver tight end standpoint, if you're just isolating them, very good argument for some of these other teams versus the Chiefs. But when you add the whole package, I'm fine with the Chiefs at two. But is this going to be the worst Chiefs supporting cast or a group of playmakers, I should say? Because the offensive line, we've talked about that a ton this offseason. Probably going to be better. You know, solid top five offensive line in the NFL now. But are the playmakers the worst that they've had? Because Sammy Watkins, say what you want about Sammy Watkins, wasn't great there, but there were some games where he took over. And I think Mecole Hardman is good for what he is, which is if there's a Sammy Watkins caliber receiver on the team and he's a slot lower on the depth chart and he is a guy that's catching jet sweeps and the whole thing and running the seam, which he showed as a rookie, the speed, right? Just the speed component and the explosiveness that Hardman adds to the mix when Tyreek Hill's also on the field. I think Hardman's fine for what he is. And last year, he only averaged 12.8 yards per reception, but Mahomes missed him in that first Bucs game. He had a 95-yarder where he was wide open. That changes the whole dynamic of just his stat output. Hardman's a big play threat. But is this going to be the worst group? Like, the Chiefs still kind of need that dependable receiver that's a third option. Let Hardman just be the explosive threat, and I don't know if that guy's on the roster. I think they're hoping it's Cornell Powell, their fifth-round pick.
Don't forget they brought back DeMarcus Robinson, so all problems solved.
But that's the problem, right? Yeah. Byron, here's who is competing for the starting wide receiver job opposite Tyreek Hill. DeMarcus Robinson had a 60 grade last year. That's been his career baseline.
Yes.
Byron Pringle had a 59 grade last year. Antonio Callaway, who I have been a big fan of throughout the years, and you've never really liked, but he's had off-field issues, he's had hands issues. He's an explosive playmaker as well. He's just been incredibly inconsistent. Mecole Hardman also is kind of in that mix, however you want to.
It's also like a giant off-field red flag. Giant off, can't stay right on the field. Like, even if he was an amazing receiver, and you know everyone's always been enamored by the guy's talent, I don't think he's ever been a particularly good player, but like, even if he was, you can't trust him to be there, so he's probably not the guy.
So he's in the mix. Mecole Hardman's technically in the mix, but you'd rather him be your third wide receiver. Gerrig Dieter is in there. Marcus Kemp, Cornell Powell, who I just mentioned they just drafted. So, I mean, they would love it. They would love for it to be Powell, but he's a fifth-round pick. It's not like you're saying, hey, fifth-rounder, like, you know, we were holding out on you. We really think you're a first-round player. You're right. Going to step in and play. So I think there are some question marks.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the weakest supporting or the weakest receiving group that he's had. On the other hand, it is still Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce. So assuming those two guys stay healthy, like, it's a great place to be. And a lot of teams would kill for that. They don't just have the one weapon in terms of Davante Adams. They have two guys that are arguably, you know, top one, top three in their position. And Andy Reid, the offensive line, Patrick Mahomes, the whole package is still really good. It's just that more than ever now, they're in a real issue if either of those guys get hurt.
I wonder if there's a little bit more on Clyde Edwards-Helaire's plate too, because one of the things we really liked about him coming out of LSU is the ability to line up all over the place and work the slot, play wide receiver. You know, maybe he becomes more of that mismatch type of guy with the Chiefs. But look, I'm okay with putting the Bucs one and the Chiefs two. If we're taking in coaching, we're taking in all of that. What about the Cowboys and the Bills? Last year, we ranked both of them, I believe, in the top five. The Cowboys, from a grading standpoint, disappointed in part because they didn't have Dak. Mm-hmm. They didn't catch the ball that cleanly, but we're talking about guys that just get open with Amari Cooper, CD Lamb, Michael Gallup as that top trio. And then the Bills, Stephon Diggs, Cole Beasley, Gabriel Davis is back. He was one of those guys, too, that ran faster, in Eric's numbers, ran faster than his 40 time, and you kind of saw that, average 17 per catch. And then Emmanuel Sanders, even though he's pushing our age, Sam, that dude still knows how to get open. Yeah. I think he's going to be just a really solid, you know, outside receiver that adds another guy at the intermediate level.
Yeah, the Bills are interesting because they are very deep at receiver, but they have an interesting group because they're very they're very role specific. Like, they don't have this situation where number one, number two, number three, they can all do a little bit of everything and they're kind of worse versions of each other. You know, number two is just like Dallas is a little bit like this, right? All three of those guys are capable of playing pretty much everywhere and doing a little bit of everything. And You know, CeeDee Lamb is a sort of worse version right now than Amari Cooper. And Michael Gallup is like a worse version of both of them. But all three guys are vaguely interchangeable in terms of what you can actually ask them to do. Now, they've, even though that's the case, they've sort of, they have kept them as relatively defined roles. Like CeeDee Lamb was the slot guy last year, even though he could be an outside number one receiver and all those kinds of things. But Buffalo, it's a little bit different, where you had like the deep threat last year,
you have defined
John Brown
roles.
You had the underneath slot guy that worked the middle of the field, Cole Beasley. You had Stephon Diggs, who comes in and can do a little bit more of everything as the true number one. But when you lost one of those guys, it left like this hole in the offense if you weren't able to replace him with an exact like-for-like replica of that role. So when John Brown went down, which happened quite a bit, there was something missing. Like, they weren't able to just plug in Gabriel Davis, for regardless of how fast he's able to run and the big plays he was able to make. He didn't quite replicate that role within the offense. And so it was like something, the engine wasn't running right anymore. It was like there was a misfire in it. So I'm curious what that looks like this year. Now that John Brown is gone, can Gabriel Davis step into that role with a sort of full offseason to prep for it? Does Emmanuel Sanders buy you a little bit more wiggle room there in terms of being a guy that can still really do a little bit of everything, even if he's old and even if he's, you know, probably declining at this point? He still is quite a well-rounded receiver. So does that kind of build up a little bit more robustness to this receiving group, or is it still in trouble if you get an injury because of how very specialized they are?
Yeah, I think Sanders, this isn't to say John Brown is some like all-pro receiver, but I do think Sanders and Gabriel Davis combine to replace John Brown, of course, and then some. But John Brown added a deep threat, and he was really good at that all extremely valuable intermediate 10 to 19 yard level. That's where Sanders shines. He's graded 70 or better in all but two of his 11 years in the league. And even the last couple of years,
he's a really good deep threat.
Yeah. Sanders can get open, and Davis at the deep level.
When you talk about deep threat, you tend to picture just run goes, right? Like just
sure.
Run straight down the field and somebody's going to put the ball over your shoulder, touchdown. But John Brown is a really, really good deep threat in terms of the variety of routes he can run beyond 20 yards downfield, for a target that goes beyond 20 yards downfield. So posts, corners, those sort of deep, the Julio Jones, those kind of blaze outs that Julio runs,
yeah.
Like all those kinds of things, John Brown is exceptional at. And Gabriel Davis may be able to match him in a foot race deep down the field and be as good a go ball threat, but he's not the complete receiver that Brown is deep down the field.
So since we're talking Bills Cowboys, like it's the early 90s Super Bowls here, Sam. If, you know, I'm in my article focused on receivers and tight ends. If we're connecting offensive line and running backs here, of course, the Bills spent the whole offseason, the fans at least, asking, saying, hey, we need a running back. Devin Singletary returns. Zach Moss returns. They bring in Matt Breida. Bring back Darrell Williams at right tackle. So solid offensive line, solid group of running backs. I think they're fine from a running back standpoint if their run blocking improves just a little bit. Mm-hmm. But does Dallas then have the edge there? Their offensive line was not good last year. But they had health issues. They had, and they just had guys not playing. They didn't have their starting tackles the entire season. Tyron Smith, for whatever is left of him, is back. Lyle Collins is back. Zach Martin at right guard, number two guard in the league. Connor Williams is one of the better guards in today's NFL. So Cowboys with their line, Zeke Elliott, Tony Pollard, probably have the edge there.
Yeah, I think Dallas's offensive line can get back to being very good. Equally, though, I can imagine a world where it doesn't play well.
Yeah.
Which is the first time that's been the case, you know, outside of the scenario they had last year, which is, hey, if like three or four guys get injured, what happens to this offensive line? That's going to take down pretty much every offensive line in the NFL. But if we assume it's healthy, this is the first time in a number of years where you can look at that offensive line and say, like maybe it isn't actually that good. Like Tyron Smith at this point is being held together by like chewing gum and tape. Lyle Collins, that was a major injury that kept him out for the whole year. The center position obviously took a huge step back when Travis Frederick retired. So it's Connor Williams, like he's one of the better guards in the NFL. I think we ranked him like 16th or something. On the other hand, guard is really thin and Connor Williams isn't actually that good.
But when you're talking about ranking against the, I'm doing offensive line rankings next. Those will be out next Monday. We'll have a breakdown of that. I think Dallas still ends up in the they'll end up in the top 8 or 10.
No, I think they do. And when you look, it's but for the first time, I think there's quite a broad spectrum of outcomes that this offensive sure. line can have going forward. Usually you just look at the guys they have and you're like, "Ah, that's a top 5 offensive line. It's going to be good." There's no way that that isn't good unless, you know, 3 guys get hurt. Now you're looking at it, you're like, "Okay, they're probably pretty good." On the other hand, like if Tyron Smith A, gets hurt, which is likely. B, doesn't play that well because he's held together by, you know, medical equipment at this point. Like, Biadasz doesn't take a step forward. Connor Williams isn't actually that good. Lyle Collins doesn't get back to his best. Now you're like, it's Zach Martin trying to, like, get this thing done by himself as a right guard, which is not going
to
happen.
I can't wait to talk O-line next week and hear about the various ways you describe Tyron Smith being held together.
Yeah.
It's by tape and medical equipment, and he only had a 67 grade last year. It was 154 snaps, but yeah, Smith has been banged up and or just less effective.
But he's reaching, I mean, he's reaching this point of like, you remember when Jason Peters
was, I was
like,
about to say,
you're yeah. going
to
get like 9 games of all pro play out of him.
Yeah,
but you know he's going to miss however many games over the season. And Tyron even, Smith is probably the same now. He's going to miss time, and the question is, how good is he when he isn't missing time, and then what have you have behind him when he does miss those games?
Tyron Smith has not graded above 85 since 2016. He's right. been good. He's been solid. Hasn't been all pro play, even when out there. So that's part of the, whether you're playing hurt or whatever, he's clearly, just watching him play, we'll get into it more next week, you could tell he's not the same guy. So I think Dallas and the Bills are in that mix for the third spot behind the Bucs and the Chiefs. Let's make I would go Dallas and then the Bills, as far as supporting cast goes, if we're ranking these. Are we ranking them on the show? Or are we just talking best and worst?
We just talk best and worst. We
don't okay. have the, we I want have the we don't want people to hold
it against us. No. I think the only other teams that you could throw into the mix for this, I think San Francisco goes in there largely because Kyle Shanahan. Like, I think the receiving
you're including core, him, yeah.
I think the receiving core is really good and the offensive line is okay. And then, like the Chiefs, like Kyle Shanahan is going to make up for a lot of talent deficiency versus some of these other teams.
Talk through this with me really quick. Currently, tomorrow it'll be finalized, but right now I have the Niners at 7.
Yeah.
Just ranking receivers and tight ends, yeah. which feels, as I'm going through this, it feels high. But then I look at, so George Kittle.
Because I could potentially put him even higher than that.
Well, that's why I wanted to talk through it. How valuable is the George Kittle factor, right? It's huge. Just like Kelsey, there's 3-4 of these guys in the NFL now that we think are complete
also remember, like,
game changers at tight end.
We haven't even really seen this receiving core together. Like, George Kittle, Brandon Ayuk, Deebo Samuel, these are not conventional receivers, but they're all really good. Kyle Juszczyk, this, if you get all this group together healthy with Kyle Shanahan pulling the strings, that's a really, really good and deep receiving core.
Oh,
have the conventional number one superstar wide receiver that we're used to.
I'm trying to take Shanahan out of this for a minute just to look at receivers and tight ends. In
terms of receiving talent, I think that's better than some of the teams ahead of it.
Okay. So if I put them at 7th, say, with receiver and tight end, then you add in the Shanahan factor, you add in Juszczyk, the fact that you add in the offensive line, which is one of the better, you have Mike McGlinchey and, you know, our guy, you know, and Trent Williams, you know, two the best run blocking tackles in the league. So yeah, there's a lot to like there with the Niners. They are, when you add all of that together, they definitely are in the mix when it comes to Cowboys, Bills, and that next tier behind, I'd say, the Bucs and Chiefs.
Yeah, definitely. I think that 49ers, that's why we've been talking about the idea that, hey, whoever gets drafted at number 3 overall has got a pretty good chance of winning Rookie of the Year if he plays early. And I still think that's true for Trey Lance. Like, the amount of people that have just decided that this guy is a project that needs to sit for a year, I'm not buying it. I think if they play him Week 1, and I don't see a real reason why they shouldn't, Trey Lance could and should win Rookie of the Year. The other team that I think would be in the mix is Denver. They've assembled this incredible roster and just need a quarterback to come in and steer the ship. Not even steer the ship, take advantage of it. Like, Denver's receiving core is really good. Now, it's a little bit more of a projection, I think,
yeah,
than a team like San Francisco. But if you lean back on what you knew those guys could do coming out, Jerry Jeudy, in the NFL, is one of the better route runners in the league. Forget college as a prospect, whatever. Right now, Jerry Jeudy in the NFL is one of the better route runners in the NFL. KJ Hamler can be a a sort of designated slot deep threat, a guy, you know, there's a role for that that's dangerous. Yeah. He can be that guy. Cortland Sutton can come back and be a number one wide receiver. Tim Patrick is still there, who's a good player. Albert O, the tight ends, Noah Fant, like that is a really, really good group of receivers, albeit with a little bit of projection because like we haven't seen the quarterback capable of taking advantage of it yet.
A big part of it is they just need to catch the ball better too. Judy had 12 drops last year with the five.
So
and
much
the one
of that
game.
Is quarterback driven.
Yeah, I get it too. But you also, when we look at drops, it's one of those things where it's gonna hurt your grade and all that stuff. But we know it tends to fluctuate a little bit. And unless there are a few guys who just don't catch the ball very well.
Yeah.
And it's a big hindrance because they don't make up for it elsewhere. I imagine I could see Jerry Jeudy having a year with five or six drops. He had five in a game last year, but I could see him this year having five or six drops, you know, catching a higher rate of passes, but also just being open often as he is.
Amari Cooper,
Judy's going to have a big year.
Amari Cooper is a good example. I think Amari Cooper had 18 or 20 drops in his first year, and everyone was like, "Oh, Amari Cooper can't catch the ball." Like, and remember, I think it was his last but one college season. He had a ton of drops as well, so it was like Cooper's sort of alternating years where he can't catch. Like, had a ton of drops his penultimate year in college, didn't have many in his final year, then dropped 18 or 20 in his first year in the NFL. It's like, what is going on here? But it's a perfect, like, Amari Cooper is a great example. Sometimes you drop the ball and they come in bunches and you're like, that's a little bit concerning, but don't read too much into it, particularly when you have a crappy quarterback throwing you the ball. Because at times last year, it was like Judy would be wide the hell open, Drew Lock would airmail the pass 5 yards above his head. Like, at some point, that's going to mess with your concentration, which is really what drops are most of the time, right?
It is not.
It's just a failure of concentration when the ball arrives. If you've spent the entire game getting open, turning around, looking for the ball, and watching it,
you're just
sail over your head or into the turf.
You just want to blame Drew Lock for everything.
Not for everything, but for this. Like, I'm just saying that there's no way that doesn't screw with your concentration. Now, I'm not saying that is. Like, that's a little bit Judy's fault as well, right? Like, at some point, it's on you to be better at concentrating.
Steve Smith would downgrade him immediately.
Absolutely. Agreed. So Steve Smith would be all about that in terms of saying, look, that is, it's on the receiver. Like, you can't do that. You have to be better than that. You have to maintain your concentration, even though your quarterback is screwing you. On the other hand, I think that's a very understandable thing. And more to the point, is something that immediately gets fixed if the quarterback changes, you know?
Yeah.
And if he isn't seeing five targets that hit the dirt before one that hits him in the hands.
I want to discuss a couple more teams, but first, I want to tell you about how PFF has partnered with Symbol, that's S-I-M-B-U-L-L, the stock market for sports that allows you to trade sports teams like stocks and earn real cash payouts when your teams win. Symbol has blended sports and the stock market to offer you a new way to invest in and profit off your favorite teams, all these teams we're talking about right now. MLB is in full swing for the rest of the summer, allowing you to earn daily cash payouts. And NFL free agency always continues. It's June 1st. More moves are going to be made. So whenever there's a big move, be sure to see how your team's stock can rise or fall. Use promo code PFF and deposit $10 at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free PFF annual subscription. That's promo code PFF with a $10 deposit at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free annual subscription. A couple teams I want to throw in the mix here. Then I want to add the Julio Jones factor. Los Angeles Rams have incredible depth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see like little stars in my eyes every time I see DeSean Jackson's name. The guy's played 200 snaps the last 2 years. But even when he was out there early in 2019, he was still the same deep threat. If he is DeSean Jackson that he's always been in his career, and you're adding him to Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods, guys who get open against single coverage as well as any duo in the league. I say that a lot, but like the numbers back that up. Woods and Kupp get open. Van Jefferson's there as well. DeSean Jackson, the deep threat. Tutu Atwell to kind of be the understudy to DeSean Jackson. That's a really nice group. And Tyler Higbee's a good solid tight end as well.
Yeah.
And then you add in the rest of the factors you want to add in for the show.
Right. And you can probably work on the basis that this has a similar but less powerful effect than the Drew Lock thing we were just talking about, right? Jared Goff to Matthew Stafford should be an upgrade and should be a change in approach and just the way the quarterback functions within this offense, right? Stafford is going to give those guys more of a chance to make plays than Jared Goff did most of the time. Whether or not that shakes out to like overall that much of a leap forward in terms of how the quarterback actually performs, debatable, but he should make the receiving core look better, which is what we're talking about here. So yeah, I agree. I think the Rams have a good receiving group, particularly if DeSean Jackson can stay healthy and add that designated deep threat to the offense. The big question to me with this group is, can that offensive line stay as good as it was last year? Like, their offensive line really has been the story of this team during the Sean McVay tenure. Like, it's bounced all over the shop, from disaster to great to somewhere in the middle. Last year was pretty good.
Like, Andrew, so much better than 2019.
Yeah, yeah. And Andrew Whitworth is in this world of Tom Brady right now, where you're like at some point Whitworth has to stop playing this well, right? Because he's that old. It hasn't happened yet. He was still by far the best player on that offensive line last year. Does that decline come this year? If not, do the rest of the guys take any kind of step backwards from what we saw last year? Just they're one of the offensive lines with this massive broad spectrum of outcomes. They could be a really, really good unit and you don't have to worry about it and the platform that offense needs, or they could go back to being actually kind of a problem and it undermines the good work of everything else.
Just for perspective, Whitworth has graded since 2017 better than Tyron Smith.
Yeah.
Since going to the Rams, he's graded in the 80s every year except that 2019 season where everybody seemed to struggle with the Rams. And he is legitimately older than both of us, Sam. He's 3 months older than
me.
He's 39. He's heading into his year 39 season. He'll turn 40.
He's a whole year older than me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he turned 39 before me. Makes him older. Older than me.
Well, he's
he'll turn 40 during the season.
God.
Andrew Weber at left tackle.
Yeah.
And there's really, you know, it would have, last year at this time, we're like, oh, is this the decline? And then he bounces 86.8 grade last year. Now he missed some time. So that's part of the aging process, right? You get injured or whatever, you know, and you do miss more time. But yeah, Whitworth is still hanging on. And
he did, though,
really
like, even though he missed time, the recovery was pretty freaking quick.
Oh, yeah.
So like,
he's incredible.
But, you know, one of the things I think is, A, when you get older, you miss time because you start to break easier. Like, things that wouldn't have done anything to you in the past suddenly break components of your body and you're missing time. But also, the recovery takes longer. So you don't come back at the same pace as you used to.
Yeah.
But Whitworth came back pretty freaking quick. It was like, that's a season that he's done for the year. And actually, no, he's coming back for the playoffs. Huh. Like, that's surprising. And, you know, some players, when I tweeted that out, it was kind of an amazing recovery, were like, eh, you know what, it's kind of standard for that type of injury. Like, yeah, but it's standard for a guy who's 24, not for a guy who's 40. Like,
right.
Okay, it's a standard recovery, which in and of itself is ridiculous for a guy who's pushing 40. Like, his ability, so he did miss time last year, and that is part of getting older. On the other hand, it doesn't seem that, you know, he's going to miss time, and those are going to be sort of more and more problematic things in the future, because his recovery was still pretty quick.
He had not given up more than one pressure in a game the entire year until he got hurt, and then he gave up 5 in each of the playoff games. So, you know, clearly, even with the recovery, still wasn't the same player. But, man, still hanging on, man. So the Rams are in that mix. The one other question I want to pose here is the Julio Jones factor. We're going to talk about the worst supporting cast in a minute. I think the so from a wide receiver tight end standpoint, I have the Titans among the league's worst. If you add in Derrick Henry, and maybe the offensive line is going to be solid enough, the Titans are probably a little bit higher. But just receivers and tight ends, it is legitimately A.J. Brown and a million question marks. We don't know.
Yeah.
But if Julio Jones signs in Tennessee, I know, so there's reports about him going to Tennessee, going to Seattle.
Yeah.
If the Titans get Julio Jones, I think just in my rankings, they might go from 29th to 10th, just receivers and tight ends, just with Julio Jones and A.J. Brown together. But if Seattle... Is anyone else in the mix? But if Seattle...
The 49ers were supposed to be in it briefly, though it seems like that's...
The Patriots were the favorites
Patriots
for a while,
well,
too.
Yeah.
The Patriots would take a big jump. But the Seahawks right now have it 10th. And I think, again, it depends on how much you want to weigh the top guys, DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, versus the rest. Do you believe in Dwayne Eskridge emerging as that number three, or Gerald Everett being like a really nice extra piece as a receiving tight end? I think there's a world where that exists for Seattle. But if they had Julio Jones, they're maybe number two. They're behind the Bucs.
So I think the current odds are Titans, Patriots, Seahawks, 49ers, and then everyone else some distance.
If the Niners were to get him, they're up in Bucs range.
Yeah, if the Niners get him.
If the Seahawks get him, they're probably just behind the Bucs at two. They're competing with the Cowboys, Chiefs, Bills
Yeah.
in that mix. If Seattle had Julio Jones, DK Metcalf,
Tyler Lockett, and then Eskridge for whatever he can do as a depth piece, that's pretty freaking nice.
That's really and Gerald Everett.
Yeah, Gerald.
I love Gerald Everett.
I mean, basically, Julio Jones transforms anybody inside the top half of the group in the top half of receiving weapons in the NFL. They become arguably the best.
All right,
like that's so, what he does, and right. They take a team like Tennessee, who's almost at the bottom of the NFL, to somewhere in the top third.
And that's factoring in a slightly declined Julio, older injury aspect. It's not, I wouldn't even assume prime Julio, but you just, there is that upside that he's going to be that same guy, that 90 plus grade receiver that is added to the mix and completely changes somebody's group of pass catchers. All right, let's go to the bottom end. The worst supporting casts in the NFL. Here's what I have from a ranking standpoint. Here's your spoiler alert. For wide receivers and tight ends, I got the Texans last. I have the Lions second to last. I think there's a legitimate debate. But just receivers and tight ends, legitimate debate between those two teams. I didn't want to do it, but the Eagles at 30. And I think the Eagles could be far better than the Lions or the Texans. I think there's a big difference there. But who are the Eagles better than? The teams that I put just above them were the Titans, who's just A.J. Brown right now. And then the Jets, and then the Saints. I have it 27th. So let's embrace debate. Just looking at receivers and tight ends, that's where I have them. If we're looking at the whole thing, Texans certainly the worst in the league right now. Their line
probably,
is
probably, yeah.
The more I look at the Texans roster, though, it's like their line is okay. You know, the line's not
the
that
line isn't
bad.
Terrible. Yeah, the line is not terrible. The receiving core kind of is. Like, it's Brandon Cooks.
Yeah, but
nobody.
Like Randall Cobb's still decent. Kiki Cutie, love him. Dante Moncrief, no.
Yeah.
But with all the resources that they threw at there, it doesn't – I don't look at that in isolation and think that's the worst in the NFL.
No,
with the Lions, I could look at the Lions and think that's the worst in the NFL, but they've got some size and Hockenson and the whole thing.
Yeah, the Lions have TJ Hockenson. Their offensive line is going to be interesting because that could be a pretty good group. Like Taylor Decker is a solid left tackle. Frank Ragnow is one of the best centers in the NFL, now the highest paid center in the NFL. Penei Sewell comes in to play right tackle, which kicks the big V into guard, which I think is actually a pretty intriguing move that could make that spot better. Like he wasn't a terrible tackle and he's a monster. Like that, if you're pivoting towards this sort of, hey, road grading offensive line full of beasts, that could go pretty well. And then Jonah Jackson is a guy who didn't grade particularly well, but we really liked as a prospect coming out. So if you're willing to project a kind of year two jump for him, like that offensive line could be pretty good. The problem is like, who are the receivers? And it's really not good. Like it's Breshad Perriman, who wasn't able to maintain, you know, the crazy small sample size play that made him look really good and finally having broken out. So Breshad Perriman probably isn't good. Tyrell Williams, Geronimo Allison, Quintez Cephas, and then Amon-Ra St. Brown, who they just drafted, who actually has a real pathway through to being like a starting receiver really quickly. I mean, it's just not a good group. It's TJ Hockenson and then some bodies.
Maybe it's just me because I always see this. I could see the world where Perriman's, you know, he's not a number one. Tyrell Williams isn't a number one. But Tyrell Williams has averaged over 15 per catch in his career. He just hasn't been on the field a whole lot the last couple of years. He's a good complimentary piece. Perriman's a good complimentary piece. They don't look bad, but there's a big – it's like what we said about the Jets last year, of which Perriman was a part. It's
and
a whole lot of what
ifs. Pan out because
right. They're big, though. When you look at it – because I always get to make an old Jaguars comparison. Remember the old Jaguars receiving core? Matt Jones,
6'6". Yeah, a bunch
6'6".
Of big old slow guys.
Reggie Williams, 6'4". Ernest Wilford, 6'4". That's what the Lions have built here, a bunch of tall, big-bodied receivers. And that, as much as you like to joke about Dan Campbell, the Dan Campbell comparison could be Jack Del Rio, who built just based off size. He wanted big receivers. He had the two big defensive tackles, and that's kind of how the Lions have built their team. And there might be a comparison there. And they always were great at stopping the run and, you know, not so much stopping the pass in Jacksonville. But they do have a big receiving core. There are just so many question marks in Detroit.
Yeah, I don't really see a world where that is particularly good. I mean, they also have DeAndre Swift as a receiving threat out of the backfield, which when that is your group of receivers, is probably a needle mover. You know, it wouldn't be for a lot of teams, but actually he might be a pretty important part of that passing game.
And last year at this time, I loved the combination of Kenny Golladay, he's gone, Marvin Jones, he's gone, Danny Amendola was a nice number three in slot and was productive, and he's gone. And then it's like, okay, then you have Hockenson at tight end, then you have DeAndre Swift. They do add Darren Fells too. I mean, another monster, 6'7", has been a really good red zone threat for the Texans the last couple of years. So there's a world where the Lions are sneaky good as far as the, you know, playmakers go. There's just so many what ifs there. The Texans, similar what ifs. The offensive lines aren't.
I think the Eagles receiving corps is a really interesting one because it should be so much better than that ranking. But
this has been the last couple
of
years.
Will be.
They fooled me 2 years ago, and we ranked them among the best in the league. I don't remember where.
But then everybody got injured.
That was almost an
asterisk one, like the Cowboys' offensive line.
But even last year, coming into the year, they had the great stars in my eyes. They had DeSean Jackson on the roster, right?
So number one to start with.
Yep. Yeah. So they had Jalen Reagor. They had Alshon Jeffrey. All those guys were on the roster. They were just more injury issues and all that. So
yeah,
the last 2 years, by the way, just real quick, the Eagles' receivers ranked 32nd in each of the last 2 years.
Yeah.
In receiving grade.
It's been bad. I'm not arguing that. What I will say last year, though, is that so everybody got hurt again for like the second year in a row. But then when that happened, players started to actually emerge as useful players. And then when everybody got healthy again, it was almost like they couldn't figure out how it's supposed to go together. So a little bit like Buffalo's receiving corps, where you're like, this is a very specialized group that individually fits together as a neat puzzle and creates this perfect, not perfect, it creates this very impressive receiving core. Like, you can essentially build the same, you know, the same structure in a couple of different ways. You can either have some very specific pieces that slot together, and when you put them together in the right order, they make this really good whole, or you can have essentially a bunch of players that are very similar and just good and put them all together and it creates the same kind of picture. The Eagles, I think, had a group that should fit together like Buffalo, but they weren't able to figure out how it worked. You know what I mean? They couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, you see these like mobile games on your, like the ads that come up on your phone, and it's like, hey, move these, here are these ridiculous pieces and they need to fit together within this shape. And you've got 8 moves to make it happen. If you can't, you're an idiot. If you can, you've got an IQ of 250 and you're smarter than Albert Einstein, right? That's basically what the Eagles were presented with. They had all these pieces. There's a way that they were supposed to fit together and create this really good receiving core, and they spent the last 6 games of the season couldn't figure out how to make it happen, right?
They're idiots.
So consequently, people got fired. That's the way this works. But Fulgham's a really good receiver, right? I genuinely,
that was the one benefit of last season is that he got to emerge as a pretty
productive player. He's a good receiver. Jalen Reagor should be able to be an extremely dangerous receiver, even as a really limited role player within the offense. Devontae Smith, if he's the player that we think he is coming into the season, is a phenomenal receiver already without having to do anything. Greg Ward, for all the like mockery of, hey, Greg Ward's your number one wide receiver, Greg Ward is not a...
If he's your four.
Right. He is a useful role player within a receiving core, and as a number four guy behind those three is useful. They've still got guys like John Hightower, like who was brought in, didn't really have a role.
Speed.
Maybe it's time to give up on J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. But, like, that is a receiving core that should be pretty good. Dallas Goedert and Zach Ertz are still on the roster. Ertz might not be by the time the season rolls around, but still, that's a plus group of receivers, in theory.
Goedert is right there with George Kittle as the only two guys with 80-plus grades as receivers and run blockers over the last 3 years. So Goedert is one of the better all-around tight ends in the league. I predicted last year he was going to end up essentially overtaking Ertz and stealing his, you know, his targets. I don't know if the actual targets, I think they were similar, but Ertz clearly, he's on his way out. He's not the same player anymore. So it's Goddard's team from a tight end standpoint. But that is, you're right. I mean, there's a path to success there for the Eagles.
My biggest concerns about this receiving core are actually not about the receiving core themselves. It's about how they're going to be influenced by the other things, right? So
Jalen Hurts?
Yes. Is Jalen Hurts good enough to actually mean you can see how good this receiving core is? Or will he Drew Lock this group? And is the new coaching staff that they brought in capable of fitting those pieces together the way the old one wasn't? Those are the two biggest areas of concern for me. Now, this group has Devontae Smith to work with that the old group didn't, but so the puzzle should be easier to solve. But those, I think, are the two biggest concerns I have, rather than just, is this group actually good? Because I think they are.
All right, let's talk Titans. They need Julio Jones more than any other team. It's not even close. It's not even
Colts?
Close.
You're not?
Well, Colts are close. It's Julio Jones has to go to the AFC South.
He should.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Titans or Colts. But I'm going to say the Titans need him more than any other team. Because despite... So the Colts bring everybody back on their receiving core. And you've been online. I don't even want to give credence to like the couple people that you've argued with, because it's just a couple people. It doesn't matter.
I mean, there's a decent chunk of people that seem to think the Colts receiving core will be good.
Because it's a whole bunch of guys that are just coming back. And again, I think the thing I've said about PFF through the years is we have a really good perspective of the league. Fans tend to only have perspective of their team. And it's like, oh, T.Y. Hilton's good.
Yeah.
And, you know, this guy's good and that guy's good. I mean, so people just see what they see and they think that, but in relation to the rest of the league, just going to read off the Colts group of playmakers here. T.Y. Hilton coming back was fantastic. That was much needed. Zach Pascal's a fine complimentary piece. I saw some hope in Michael Pittman as a second round pick. I still think he's a possession type, you know, run those slants and in cuts, but they're fine. Paris Campbell has never developed into an actual receiver, and he's battled injuries.
Yeah.
Right. So he hasn't really been on the field. So they have a million question marks, and there is no dynamic playmaker on the Colts. Mo Alie-Cox was one of the better receiving tight ends in the league. Fantastic. Good breakout season, but they're just good. They're a good, solid group, which gets you the 24th ranking probably in my receiver tight end rankings coming out.
Yeah, the people that you can paint a picture whereby everything you want to happen, the optimistic side of everything, right, where T.Y. Hilton actually rediscovers his best play of old now that he has a quarterback that's capable of pushing the ball deep down the field and, you know, a dynamic playmaker at that position potentially in Carson Wentz. Michael Pittman takes another step forward and his development becomes a really good all-around wide receiver who may be lacking a couple of things in his game, but is a real playmaker. Paris Campbell stays healthy, becomes, you know, a real factor in this offense. Like, you can do that, but the point is, like, you can do that for every team in the NFL, right?
But
like,
except maybe the Titans.
But like,
and that's my point.
The people that say that the Colts receiving core are going to be really good are the same people that paint the picture of like, hey, the Steelers offensive line is going to be amazing, or the Vikings secondary is going to be great. Like, you can create that narrative for any questionable unit in the NFL. It's just that if you're going to do that, what happens if you do that for the other 31 teams in the league, right?
Right.
If you paint the optimistic, like if you did, I just did it for the Eagles, essentially, right?
You did.
If you paint the same scenario.
They're still 30th in the rankings.
Well, not just that, but they're better. Like, yeah. if you look at the best scenario for the Eagles receiving core is better than the best scenario for the Colts receiving core. Like, that, they're more talented.
I could see that, yeah.
So if you're going to do that for all the other 31 teams, you're not good. Like, you can't only look at the most optimistic output of the way this is going to go. You have to look at, like, what is the average? What's the middle of the range of outcomes that this group is going to have? And the middle of the range of outcomes for the Colts receiving core is pretty bad.
So that brings me to the Titans, because it's A.J. Brown, star, stud. And again, when it comes to rankings, how do we handle this? I had to do, last year with Washington, it was like, you have Terry McLaurin and nobody. Where do you rank that?
Yeah.
Right now you have A.J. Brown, star, stud, everything. He's awesome. Beyond him, Josh Reynolds, who finally got a chance to play over 900 snaps last year, graded at 65 for the Rams. He's just, I mean, he's a 3-4 receiver. You know, that's what he is, a 3 or 4. He's slated to start opposite A.J. Brown. The other guys on the depth chart, Cameron Batson, a couple rookies, Racy McMath and Des Fitzpatrick, Chester Rogers is in there, Marcus Johnson, Mason Kinsey. Like, who's actually going to line up at receiver for the Tennessee Titans? And then you go to tight end. They lose Jonnu Smith. Anthony Firkser is a really nice, you know, move tight end. He's pretty good against single coverage. He's an undersized tight end. You have him and Jeff Swaim. Jeff Swaim hasn't graded above 70 in about 4 years now. That's the only time in his career he's done it. A couple undrafted free agents from last year, Jared Pinkney, Tommy Hudson. I mean, who is catching passes for the Titans? This is the team that needs Julio Jones more than anybody else. It is literally A.J. Brown, a number 4 receiver in Josh Reynolds, and a whole bunch of massive question marks, and a move tight end. That's what they have, just as far as pass catchers go. of course, Derrick Henry and the way they run the ball. If we're looking at overall supporting cast, that's going to help. The Titans need Julio Jones more than anybody, though.
It's incredible that the potential difference he makes to this team, because, you know, A.J. Brown makes that kind of difference as well. And we saw what happened when Corey Davis didn't have to be the number one last year. He could be a foil to A.J. Brown, and suddenly Corey Davis has this career year. If all you have is A.J. Brown, it becomes really easy to defend the Tennessee Titans. Now, okay, you got to focus on Derrick Henry and stopping the run as well. But in terms of the pass game, you can roll everything over to A.J. Brown. You don't have to worry about the other side of the field. Like, you're not concerned at all about Josh Reynolds beating up your number two corner. Like, most teams in the NFL would think that's a massive mismatch in their favor on the defensive side of the ball, even if you left him completely on an island. You change that to Julio Jones, and now it's like, well, either one of those guys destroys single coverage. So what the hell are we going to do? We've got, they're on opposite ends of the field. We have to play this honestly with a, you know, essentially, you know, split down the middle field. This is a nightmare.
Here's a question. Where does Ryan Tannehill rank as a wide receiver on the Titans?
Oh, God. I mean, he makes the team.
He makes the team. He definitely makes the team. He might be third.
I don't know. When was the last time?
Chester Rogers? I mean, Des Fitzpatrick and Racy McMath are rookies. You know, we don't, but, you know, Fitzpatrick
graded 73 in the ACC. But genuinely, he might make the team as a wide receiver.
Ryan Tannehill's a receiver on this team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That in and of itself, which I keep saying, God damn it. That is crazy.
There you go. You didn't need those extra
words. No, I didn't. It's just superfluous.
Nice Titan.
Complete waste of time.
Titan is concise.
Yeah.
I like it. So I got the Titans as one of the worst supporting casts in the NFL. I got them at 29 right now, just looking at receivers and tight ends. Add Derrick Henry. I think the offensive line is going to be solid, especially for how much they're going to run the ball. They got a good group of run blockers. Taylor Lewan coming back. So for this podcast, they're not among the worst. When we're adding in O-line, when we're adding in Derrick Henry, they're probably closer to 20 maybe. But if Julio Jones...
And they're one of the few teams in the league where I think you have to actually factor in the run game.
Like
most teams, the run game, and particularly the running backs, are not a factor in terms of like supporting cast for the quarterback. As much as, you know, the old narrative of, hey, a quarterback's best friend is a powerful run game, it isn't. Like, we know better than that at this point. So most teams, you're not even really factoring in the run game as like a major boost to the quarterback. Tennessee, you are. Like, the Titans have had games where Derrick Henry has been the reason they've won, and they've been able to just hand the ball off to him, even when it's not a great situation, and just watch him make magic happen. A.J. Brown, the same thing, in receiver. But Derrick Henry is a factor in their supporting cast overall.
Julio Jones, dude factor, man.
Yes, adds to the dudes.
So I would say, too, if the Titans get Julio Jones, they're the team I've been as concerned. There's a few teams I've just been concerned with their off seasons. The Steelers, the Raiders. I feel like there's backwards moves and then slight steps forwards, right? Forward. The Titans were a team that I thought took a massive step back. They just lost a bunch of players, had massive question marks in important areas. And if they had Julio Jones, they will have maybe solved all of them. When you talk about adding in Janoris Jenkins this offseason, adding in Caleb Farley in the first round. They did have a good solid draft all around, bringing in starting tackle potentially and Dylan Raiduns. So they filled a lot of their needs that I thought were really risky this offseason. The one remaining is that wide receiver. And you know, I keep saying, hey, maybe they call about Tim Patrick and Denver and all stuff, but I would much rather the Julio Jones move for the Titans.
Of course.
I don't want to see what Ryan Tannehill would do with a lesser group of playmakers. Yeah, despite how good he's looked these last couple of years.
I mean, it's a question you don't want answered. Like, why would you deliberately try and undermine the guy's supporting cast, hoping that he can make the difference up or that he doesn't suffer a drop-off despite that? Like, Tennessee allowed that receiving group. And if it was only the loss of Corey Davis, Hall of Famer that he is, it would be, okay, fine. It's a move you have to make sometimes.
Anytime you can replace one Hall of Famer with another.
Of course. But it's Corey Davis and Jonnu Smith. Like, it's two significant parts of an offense that admittedly doesn't pass the ball as much as others, but now you've gone from, like, three viable receiving weapons to one. So, like, give him two. Like, put it back to two at least.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's huge. So as far as ranking the worst supporting cast. I don't know if there's any other team in the mix here. As far as my receiver tight end rankings, the Jets, I still have at 28. So there are teams where I like the moves that they're making. The Jets are one of them. I thought the Patriots made a lot of moves to get better this offseason, but it's still tough to put them outside of the 20s as far as just, you know, pass catcher rankings. Patriots offensive line would move them up a little bit here. Even the Jaguars, I like a lot of what the Jaguars have, but that tight end situation is horrendous. You would like to have another.
They just signed Tim Tebow.
You would like to have another pass catching threat.
And you don't think Tim can do that?
Maybe ETN at receiver.
Yeah. That so
that took way too much heat, by the way. We mentioned this before, but the ETN, like he's going to work out at receiver, took way too much heat.
So here's the thing, right? Urban Meyer is taking a lot of crap because he signed Tim Tebow, and that's kind of a joke. And then he...
It's going to matter nothing.
But then he doubled down. Or I don't know if he even said this or if this was a report, but then it was like, hey, Tim Tebow might see some, like, Taysom Hill goal line snaps and, you know... make you know the Taysom Hill package and cause some problems for teams that way, and that's when everyone like lost their mind, starts throwing the toys out of the pram, and it's like you would take the ball out of Trevor Lawrence's hands to give it to Tebow so that he can like throw a left-handed, you know, wobbly duck across an offensive lineman in the end zone. That's ridiculous. It is. It's silly. It's stupid. It shouldn't happen. It's a bad idea. But when you couple that with the idea that he's trying to turn Travis Etienne into a wide receiver that can line up in the backfield, suddenly you start to create this picture of an offense that can actually be really, really creative. You've still got...
Oh, I'm glad you took the positive end of that instead of like thinking he was tripling down on idiocy.
No, I mean, he is, but
he's
I
not,
think...
though. Not with Etienne.
No, 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 with Tebow. I mean, that's three worlds of idiocy all in one move. But... You've got LaVisca Chenault as well. This is an offense that could be really, really difficult to defend.
Absolutely.
Now, it's kind of unique. It's not conventional, theoretically. The tight end position is garbage, even with Tebow there. But when you start to factor in this concept of, I mean, it's not positionless football, right? It isn't the offensive equivalent of what Baltimore have been doing on defense. But it's getting in that direction, and it's pushing the boundaries of a potential edge in the NFL schematically today that is still not exploited the way it should be. Like a year ago, almost exactly, I wrote the article about how the way to generate these mismatch problems on offense is wide receiver running back hybrids, but taken from the receiver aspect, right? So the NFL, like what makes Urban Meyer interesting is he's been doing this in his offenses since Alex Smith was his quarterback. Like Alex Smith is retired now at whatever he was, 39 years old, with like barely a leg left. Urban Meyer had him in college back in Utah, and that was when he first really started doing this stuff in terms of hybrid receiving weapons. He then had Percy Harvin. He then had Curtis Samuel. He's been doing this a lot, and it's still a cutting-edge idea. Not necessarily in college, but in the NFL, it is still at the boundary of what teams do. And the reason is, because the league, the NFL, has always looked at this and said, yeah, it's a really good idea, but we're going to take it from the running back perspective. If we take a running back and we find a guy that has receiving skills, Marshall Faulk, Le'Veon Bell, like if we take a guy, Christian McCaffrey, we take a guy who can go from the backfield to split out wide, that's how we cause defenses problems. Like, look at this lumbering 275-pound linebacker that has to go out into the flat and cover this dude. It's stealing money, right? It isn't anymore. Now, whether it was defenses just figuring that out, whether it was the fact that the game has just gone smaller, so 275-pound linebackers are now 220 pounds, and they can move in space and they can cover because that's what they do primarily, whatever the reason is, that doesn't work anymore in terms of stressing a defense. It just, they don't care. Like, we think of it as this great mismatch, like way of generating favorable matchups, and it just isn't anymore. So, but doing it the other way is still a problem. If you take a wide receiver that can line up in the backfield and actually take a handoff like he's a running back, that screws up a defense like nothing else, because it can completely manipulate box counts, which is one of the biggest differentiators in terms of just, are you going to get rushing yardage or not?
What you basically need is a receiver that is treated like a receiver.
Yes.
And if
but Etienne can take handoffs.
Is treated like a receiver. If he's so good as a slot receiver, if Christian McCaffrey played full-time slot
yes.
and was covered by a corner,
right.
then when you move him to the backfield, it's like, okay, how do I defend that?
Because you can do a few different things when you do that, right? The way you can screw around with the formations on offense and personnel, you can either essentially generate a light box, right? You can basically force them to keep an extra guy out of the box with your formation, or you can almost substitute the player in the box. So with motion and things, you know, you can start off with two guys in the backfield or change the guys you're going to have in the backfield. And that can almost essentially replace a linebacker with like a corner in the box. And that's just a mismatch. It's an advantage. You've created a mismatch in the blocking scheme. And when the guy that's running it is someone like Etienne, who isn't just a good running back, but is like a home run threat, like the dude's calling cards are sort of burst and acceleration and speed, right? So if you manage to make that mismatch and suddenly you've got a tight end blocking a cornerback and that springs him to the second level, it's potentially an even bigger deal for a guy like Etienne than it is for another guy who doesn't have that home run capability. So my point is, Urban Meyer has always done this, and now he's talking about a bunch of things that speak to this type of cutting edge offensive philosophy. That, I think, is reason to be very excited, even if a lot of it is being wrapped up in the name Tim Tebow.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care about the Tebow stuff that much, but I think
the
Etienne stuff was fine, and I think it was smart. The other part about training camp, like Trevor Lawrence couldn't hand off. He's coming off surgery, so he couldn't even hand off. And if you actually listen to Urban Meyer's quote about Etienne, he's like, why would I have him run inside zone, outside zone, and power? He knows how to do that. He's had hundreds of carries.
Yeah.
This is actually the analytical way. We wouldn't draft a running back in the first round. However, when we had a running back on our team, I would do everything. I would actually have him take every rep. In the pass game, right? Or as a receiver, and expand his repertoire, because that is your best way of maximizing his value.
He's like, worst case scenario, I end up with a running back that's now a really good receiver. Best case scenario, I create this hybrid weapon that I'm trying to create. The reason I think I care about the Tebow stuff is because the fact that he's talked about using him in a Taysom Hill style, a Taysom Hill way. Fundamentally, it's not a great idea with Tim Tebow, but because it's an extra data point in terms of this is the way he's thinking. He's thinking of matchup problems. He's thinking of ways to stress a defense with personnel and with
so even if it ends up creative LaVisca or something.
So even if it's not Tebow, or even if it is Tebow and he ultimately concludes that, you know what, Tebow's just a bad NFL player, let's not do that.
It's going to be the Luke Farrell direct snap package.
Whatever it is, the fact that he's thinking about ways to cause defensive problems beyond the play design and the personnel, like the actual player I'm putting out here. The fact that he's talking about, just by having this guy here, it causes the defense undue stress. It's a good thing.
I'll buy that. Like I said, Urban took way too much heat. Like, I get some of the Tebow backlash, even though it's roster spot 90. I get some of it. I don't get the other ETN. Did we figure out the exact what we're going to call him?
I've just decided that I've decided right now that I'm calling him Etienne, and until there's like
Etienne,
official declaration from on high,
I'll stand with you here on the PFF NFL podcast and go with Etienne. Here's what I want to hear from our listeners. Couple things. First off, don't forget, go to Sam's pinned tweet, donate, get him dressed up like minor league Steve. I also want to know if we're looking for other guests around the PFF NFL podcast. Do you want to have Eric Eager on the show with me here? Do we want another Mike Renner episode? We might have some
crossover shows.
Yeah, some crossover shows. Who else do we want to hear on the podcast? Mike Renner of 2-for-1 Drafts, going through maybe a name change over there. They're trying to expand their palette a little bit as far as their football analysis, because they do a great job over on 2-for-1 Drafts, which it's still named right now. So go subscribe to those guys. How organic is this? And then the PFF Forecast featuring George Charruri and Eric Eager. I think I want to have Eric on the show maybe next week if you're traveling.
Yeah.
As the rumor has it, you might be traveling. So I might have Eric on the show next week. I'm going to ask him right now.
You do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think there's anyone else in line as far as the worst supporting cast go. Is anyone else in the mix here? The Raiders were low here. Oh, I want to talk Saints. because just receivers and tight ends, I put him at 27. They also have a top 3 to 5 offensive line, so they're not that low, and they got Alvin Kamara. But receivers and tight ends, how concerned are you in a post-Drew Brees world that it's Michael Thomas and a whole bunch of really question marks in that group of playmakers?
Yeah, it is Michael Thomas, though. I mean, it's in the Devontae Adams realm of, hey, that can take you a really long way.
Michael Thomas. Like, and then, you know, Tre'Quan Smith, again, another complimentary type receiver. But he's probably – who's the number two receiver? It's Tre'Quan Smith, Marquez Callaway, Lil Jordan Humphrey. I mean, who is competing for that number two spot? Deontay Harris is a special team star.
It's Sheamus within the division because the Saints trading for Julio would be pretty funny. I know they've got no cap room ever, but they're the kind of team that would make that happen.
Yes. Yeah, so the Titans, as much as I say the Titans need him more than anybody.
Julio, or the Saints might, but they're not going to get that deal done.
Right. They can't make that trade with the Falcons. The Bucs should trade for Julio just to keep him away from people.
Mm.
He'd be like the number three there, you know. Just to keep them away.
Yeah, it is concerning. They don't have the depth. But they don't have the depth, and they don't have the Drew Brees to mean that you won't think about it anymore.
You think the Seahawks did Russell good by the game. Oh, he's a fifth rounder for Gabe Jackson. You're all excited about that. The Julio move. This is the move.
Extended him.
The Julio Jones, that's the move where it's like, all right, Russ, here's your guy.
Yeah.
We just gave you Julio, the next Julio,
yeah,
and you got Lockett.
Somebody tweeted this out. It was like, hey, Russell Wilson says, I'm kind of getting a bit sick about this, and the Seahawks give him, you know, DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett and Gabe Jackson and something else. It's like, well, hey, none of those guys are particularly high draft picks. And, you know, it was just silly. And then they compared it to Aaron Rodgers, who's like, hey, guys, I'm upset that you drafted my future. Like, crickets, you know? It's like, yeah, but like, it's not like Seahawks drafted a bunch of first rounders and threw them all at the offense. You know, here's your offensive line and your receiving core, Russ.
It doesn't matter. They're
all second and third picks.
But it matters that you got the right guys. It matters that you get good guys.
Right, which is why it doesn't matter that the Green Bay hasn't spent a first round pick on a wide receiver for the last 10 years.
Ridiculous narrative. That's a stupid narrative. The fact that Russell Wilson's never had an MVP vote is a stupid narrative. Of course, the media creates dumb, stupid narratives.
Stupid narrative.
What do you mean?
So
Russ never should have had – which year should he have had an MVP vote?
The year that Bobby Wagner had an MVP vote. That's the problem. It's not that, like, Russell Wilson should have ever been the MVP. It's that look at the people that have had MVP votes during the time
that Russell Wilson – just because somebody Wilson went rogue with an idiot vote doesn't mean –
of course it does.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean it doesn't justify that Russell Wilson should have had an idiot vote in 2015.
It absolutely does. It's like if you are going to go off the reservation and pick a randomer outside of the obvious MVP that year, which happens every year, that's the next guy up, not the freaking linebacker that you decided should be MVP.
The one year he should have was 2019, where if you could separate his, you know, drop off down the stretch from his playmakers like we did at PFF, you would say, hey, Russ was actually an MVP candidate in 2019, though I would not argue with anybody that voted for Lamar Jackson that year. Of course, Lamar was incredible that season. So.
No, the issue is not that Russell Wilson should have ever been MVP. It's that there's like 50 guys that have had MVP votes during the time Russell Wilson has been playing at an amazing level.
The issue is how they vote. You get one first place vote for the MVP.
Right. So somebody should have given him one.
Just make the MVP vote the same way you do the Heisman or the same way you do it in baseball, and you rank a 1 to 10 and you get a point system.
MVP, because it's a dumb award.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that. What else you want to talk about here on June 1st? June talk here.
Nothing. I'm out. I'm done.
You're done?
Yeah.
All right, great. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you all had a great Memorial Day weekend if you're in the States, or even if you're overseas, like the 14% of you that are.
That's just Ireland.
Was way just more Ireland? Than 14%. What are we, 20-some percent?
I haven't added them all up. Like, there's whatever.
It's a lot of 1%ers.
We have 66% of people from the U.S., so the rest.
33? Did you say 67% from the U.S.?
66.
So 34%?
Yes.
Were that international?
Yes.
Oh, Greg Rosenthal said they're in the 20s around the NFL. He sent me a little note. He's a big listener.
20s that are
around
international?
The NFL guy. Greg. We're going to have Greg on the show soon. Maybe I'll have him on next week.
20s that are international?
Well, if it's 66 U.S. Yeah, that are international.
So we're way more international.
Because I think I reported on the show that we were like 15 or something. I undersold us.
You did. It's 14% that are Irish.
We should try to attract more Americans, actually. You know, the American
football
fans.
Well, that's the growth area, yeah.
Yeah. growth, right. Growth area here in America. So if you're in the U.S., tell your friends about the PFF NFL podcast. So thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll be back here on Thursday with more great offseason analysis. Don't forget NFL podcast at PFF.com. That's our email address. And we're going to get you guys a part of the show probably as early as Thursday.
Send us good emails and Steve will read them out.
I'll read them out.
Particularly if you send in things that he has to pronounce on the air.
No. No pronunciation stuff. All right, guys. See you Thursday.